Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com, accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast. And I'd like to start out today reminding you that wealthformula.com is a website with all sorts of special information in there, all sorts of resources, free books, etc., free books from me, from George Newberry. Lots of goodies there, so make sure you check it out. It's also the place where you sign up for Investor Club. If you are an accredited investor and you're ready to get off the sidelines and start joining a group of like-minded individuals looking for potential opportunities, then you must go to wealthformula.com right now and sign up for Investor Club. Of course, you have to be accredited. What is accredited? It means you either make $200,000 a year as an individual, $300,000 if filing jointly, or $1 million outside of your $1 million net worth outside of your personal residence. That qualifies you. You don't have to apply. You don't have to go to the DMV or anything. You just are an accredited investor at that point, and you can sign up for Investor Club, because after all, who doesn't want to be part of a club? Right. And the other thing I want to remind you is, even if you're not accredited, you can be part of a different type of network. And a lot of you accredited investors are already part of this. But there is the Wealth Formula Network. That is our inner circle of Wealth Formula fans. And basically, this is a, you know, there's a course that creates a foundation for this, with a bunch of very familiar names like Tom Wheelwright, Ken McElroy, you know, the usual suspects, with a robust educational course. And that is followed with a mastermind, with a Facebook group that's become very active, where you can get questions answered, and also bi-weekly mastermind calls with yours truly. We do them on Zoom so we can actually see each other, and it's like a little party. We do that every other Wednesday, and it usually lasts for about an hour and a half. It's a good time. Anyway, check that out at wealthformularoadmap.com, and I'd love to see more of you participate in that, because, I mean, you seem to have an awful lot of fun at the Scottsdale event a few weeks ago, so this is basically just, you know, keeping that party going. Now, on for today's topic. Now, let's start out. Let me bring you back to the 1980s or, you know, 70s or whatever, whenever you were a kid. And you'd go to the doctor with your parents. You know, you were a kid and your parents brought you to the pediatrician. And, you know, everybody looked at the doctor and they kind of held him or her in high esteem. You know, they trusted him or her, and they thought, gosh, you know, that's a person with a lot of integrity, somebody who's smart, somebody who, you know, deserves to have a position in society of a little bit of respect, you know? They wouldn't say things like, he's just doing the test so he can go make some extra money, or he's getting kickbacks from that drug company or vaccine company, that's why he wants you to do it. Now, these are the types of things that I hear on a regular basis when I go to the YMCA every day. Drives me crazy. I'm sitting in the sauna, and that's what people are talking about. Of course, they don't know that I'm a physician. Sometimes they get me in the conversation, and then I point out, yes, I am a physician, and yes, I actually do believe that doctors are not just out there to screw you. Anyway, doctors and science, and for those of you who are of the healthcare type, you know this. We are becoming decreasingly popular these days, and it's really from, you know, both political extremes. You know, it's just, you know, you got people who are, okay, let's just say science and medicine, right? So on the science part, you got people who don't believe in climate change. Well, gosh, it's weird out there, folks. The weather's getting really weird. You don't think this is changing? And hey, guess what? Science says there is climate change, and I believe in science. So you may not believe that, but I do. All right. Now, that usually the denial of that comes from the right. But then on the left, there's this crazy denial of vaccinations and, you know, how they cause autism, although there's never been any study that actually validates that point. There was some fake study when this guy was, you know, completely, you know, found to be a big fraud. And outside from, you know, I mean, the major authority on this anti-vaxxer movement is Jenny McCarthy, a former Playboy model. And I think that in one of those other shows from the 70s. I can't remember the blonde one. Anyway, so that's from the left. But I should say the left, the most unvaccinated county in the country is Marin County, which is just near San Francisco there. So extremely liberal. And for some reason, they don't believe in science either. So it's coming from everywhere. For those of us who are people who believe in science and medicine, listen, we are, a lot of people disagree with us. And on the other hand, let me just point out, it's not just disagreement. You see, these days, it seems like doctors and scientists often are the object of not just disagreement, but of disdain from all over the place. You know, a few months back, I was at a mastermind event. A lot of you know I'm part of a few of those, and this one's for entrepreneurs, and it's a really good group. But the mastermind leader in the room asked how many quote-unquote functional doctors we had in the room. So I'm thinking to myself, wait, do I raise my hand? What's a functional doctor? So I raised my hand and I said, well, I'm a real doctor. Does that count? And of course, you see, you can imagine what kind of, there was literally 20 people in that room practicing some kind of alternative medicine without any degree at all, who called themselves some kind of doctor of non allopathic medicine, which is fine. I'm just saying. So that being the case, I being the actual only MD in the room, thought it was reasonable to ask the question if I counted as a quote unquote functional doctor. Anyway, I got hissed at from a lot of people. I actually got told I was killing people instead of helping them by one person. And then I finally got off the hook when I announced that I hadn't practiced medicine in a couple of years. And as far as I could remember, I'd never actually killed anyone. I mean, at least that I know of. Anyway, it's you will, if you're a physician or if you're in healthcare, you're a scientist anytime, any of those things. These days, you know, it's not really a good time to be us these days, because we're losing respect and we're losing reimbursement at the same time. And for those of you sticking it out, and I know a number of you are in insurance-based medicine, you're getting, you know, ramrodded every year. Keep fighting the good fight. I mean, good for you. And I know that you deserve every penny you get, and no matter what they say, I don't think you're a charlatan, and I know you don't get paid for sending somebody for an MRI or to get a blood test, like some people seem to think you do. Anyway, now I should say that I am a real doctor, or as we like to say, allopathic physician. And you know, and not just allopathic, but osteopathic guys out there too. You're real doctors too. I mean, we study the same kind of scientific medicine, but we call ourselves doctors, and that's, you know, in the old fashioned sense. Despite the fact that I'm one of those real doctors, I don't disregard alternative therapies at all. I really don't. I really don't. In my view, if it doesn't hurt you, then give it a try. If it doesn't hurt you, give it a try. I mean, we don't always know why things work until later, and that's just the truth. I mean, take aspirin. Now, I don't know the exact history, but I know that aspirin has been around for well over 100 years. I know it comes from, like, tree bark, and I'm guessing at some point, you know, someone who was in pain got, you know, was in so much pain, they just felt like they had to bite down on some bark or something, and then they felt better. And the next thing you know, people started using it for pain, and we didn't discover why it worked many, many years later. That's how things work. A lot of times things work, and then we discover why they work later. And so I'm not against alternative stuff at all. You know, another example of that is acupuncture. I mean, acupuncture has been around for centuries, man, right? The Chinese have been doing this forever, and it's been, you know, now it's been proven to be beneficial for a variety of ailments. But, you know, in Chinese medicine, it's been for centuries we've known that. But, I mean, for, you know, recently, for example, there was a study, and this is not so recently, but a couple of years ago, showing that acupuncture actually helps people with sinus problems. Now, I got to tell you, I wouldn't have believed it, frankly, until the studies came out, because I don't really kind of necessarily see the correlation. But, hey, it works. And if even before a study came out like that, if somebody said, hey, I got this bad sinus problem, people are saying, you know, acupuncture might help. What do you think, doctor? Should I give that a try? I wouldn't say no. No, go ahead. Go give it a try. You know, absolutely. If it's not going to hurt you and you think it might actually help you, then give it a go. And maybe if it works, maybe even it's a placebo effect, because the placebo effect is real. And so great, you find a placebo that works. I'm all for it. Anyway, one of the areas right now where there are plenty of non-validated treatments that many people swear by is in the area of chronic pain. And so this week on Well Formula Podcast, we're going to talk to someone who believes he has a novel means of treating chronic pain with greater than 80% efficacy. And if you want to, you can even invest in this project. And that's why this is on this show, because we are ultimately an investing show. We're not a doctor show. Anyway, this was a project that was brought to me from somebody in Wealth Formula Network, and they liked this person. So I, you know, it's a no like trust thing, but full disclaimer, I have absolutely nothing to do financially or otherwise with this company. I'm not invested, et cetera. It's just, it's for educational purposes. Like I have to tell you every time we have somebody who is raising capital, I don't have anything to do with it. I don't make any money. I'm not invested, et cetera. But anyway, when you come back, you will learn about this new offering that is in this area of chronic pain, and how you can potentially get involved when we come back.
Worried about saving too little too late for retirement? The Wealth Accelerator may be exactly what you need. With the help of some of the oldest and most reliable insurance companies in the country, Wealth Accelerator allows you to take most of the upside of any good year in the stock market and use bank loans to magnify those returns significantly. And what if the stock market has a bad year? No need to fear. Wealth Accelerator is engineered so you don't participate in the losses of the market, no matter how bad of a year it is. Sounds too good to be true, right? But it's not. It's simply the same financial engineering that the ultra wealthy have been doing for years. Now it's your turn. Check it out for yourself by going to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com. Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com.
Welcome back to the show. Today, my guest on Wealth Formula Podcast is Brendan Lundberg, who is co-founder of Radiant Pain Relief Centers. He and his partner, David Farley, who is a Harvard MIT trained physician, set out with a vision to build the safest, most consistent, effective, and appealing solution to the chronic pain epidemic that is probably underappreciated in this world. I can tell you I'm in pain right now. Anyway, Brendan and Dr. Farley opened what is called Radiant Pain Relief Centers, and they opened their first center in Portland, Oregon, in February of 2014. And following the success of the first center, they are now laying out a plan for expansion to open new centers and markets, both nationally and internationally. So, Brendan, welcome to Wealth Formula Podcast.
Thank you, Buck. I am honored to be here.
Well, that's kind of you to say. So, yeah, we were talking earlier. We know a few people in common, and actually you were referred as a potential guest from one of our Wealth Formula Network members, and so that was that's always a nice, no like trust thing that we do around here when we get somebody on the show. So let's talk a little bit about this whole chronic pain thing, which you're involved with. And
yeah.
By the way, I should point out the reason we're talking about this is there's an investment opportunity involved. We're not just talking about this on an investing show just because. But first, Brendan, obviously, you know, you're not a physician per se. You know, how'd you get involved with chronic pain? How has it affected you personally? How did you find this area?
It has affected me personally. In fact, I started developing chronic low back pain as a teenager, you know, fit, healthy, active, and kind of unknown as to why I'm experiencing this pain, experiencing my low back at a young age. And I had an uncle that was a chiropractor. So I get regular adjustments throughout my growing up years and always felt good and seemed to help resolve the pain, but never fully resolved it long term. Mm-hmm. Into my 20s, it started to get worse. I ended up I had a sister that went through massage therapy school, and I remember her doing something on me called structural integration, which is very uncomfortable massage. It's really kind of like, you know, fascial work and things. And her commenting that it looked like there was some rotation happening in my hips that was kind of strange. And talking to a sports medicine doctor who thought maybe I was getting some scoliosis or something. And, you know, his course of action was meds, watch it, keep moving. At some point, maybe we go in there and put in some rods, keep that back nice and straight. The pain doctors wanted to give me medication and injections and ultimately go in there and, you know, take some sort of surgical intervention towards it. I didn't do those things and just kind of kept living my life. And my career has been spent in healthcare related business. I'm not a physician, as you said, but I've been in healthcare related, you know, affairs my entire career, and saw an opportunity to start Radiant. And as we did, and we could talk more about that, but as we did, I got treated there, and I had developed by this point really kind of debilitating sciatica pain down my right leg and into my groin. That pain following our therapy has never returned. Now it's been over 3 years and feeling much better in that way. And then understanding the neuroscience of pain, which is really fascinating stuff and really where the science is leading, helps us identify that there's some neurologic deficiency that's causing this. And in my case, you know, the nervous system's job is to keep us alive, which means it needs to see the landscape. It needs to be able to keep us upright. The vestibular system balances us. The touching, feeling senses and proprioception, which is our orientation in space. So for many chronic pain sufferers, there's some disconnect between one of these sensory inputs and the brain or the brain's interpretation of that. And that results in the body trying to make some adaptation. In my case, I have a right eye that doesn't like to play ball like it's supposed to. And so I see just fine. So when I go to the eye doctor, it doesn't get flagged as a bad eye, but I walk around with my right eye kind of disconnected from the world. And so consequently, because my nervous system wants to keep me alive, it makes a very subtle adjustment in the positioning of my head so that my left eye is positioned to be more dominant and see the landscape. Well, that causes some compensations that have to be made throughout the spine. Otherwise, I walk in circles to my right. And so the result is a manifestation of pain in my low back. So, you know, that's kind of a long story to say there's so much kind of going on here. Our therapy is safe and effective, and I can't wait to talk about it because there's certainly...
Let's back up a little bit, and I would be remiss if I didn't try to drill down on this a little bit. I don't know if you know my background as a neurosurgeon.
Sure, absolutely.
And yeah. I have a fair amount of interest in neuroscience, and that was really kind of where I was. You said a bunch of different things, and I know it's very this is frankly something that I want to make sure that we're clear about, because there's a lot of misinformation out there, and we get into this sort of, you know, allopathic medicine is BS, and you know we're doing everything the wrong way, and that's just not true, and you know that,
right?
But let's talk a little bit about, first of all, what was it? What was it that was causing the back pain? You said you had sciatica. So did you have some kind of a disc herniation or something, or was there anatomically something that was causing you? Presumably between, if you're a groin pain, that's probably like an L2, L3, nerve, disc herniation. Is that,
no, disc
I don't want to get too technical, but I'm not, don't want to just kind of gloss over this because there's form and function and pathophysiology that you can't just get around.
You know, absolutely. So, well, you know, the body is an adaptation machine. It's made to adapt. And so, you know, understanding the neuroscience the way that we do and that we promote within our clinic is that, you know, there's a neurologic driver of function or dysfunction. And oftentimes, you know, if we think of it like the circular of a clock, with the brain being at the 12 o'clock position and then outputs of function or dysfunction, around the curvature of the clock and then back up to the brain. The brain is both taking information from the inputs of the body as well as external. So endogenous and external inputs that give it a sense of information about safety and function and movement and everything. We typically identify some level of dysfunction, pain or, joints that aren't moving like they're supposed to, and we address that. Our philosophy is that if the brain is the contributing factor to a pain experience, then if we can change the brain, it can potentially change the output and course correct itself. So I did have some, and I still probably do have some mechanical misalignment in my low back. And rather than trying to fix it there with a surgical intervention, I exercise regularly and that helps keep it at bay. But these identification tools or these assessments and drills that we do in addition to our primary therapy helped identify that my right eye wasn't really doing its job, or at least my brain wasn't interpreting that my right eye was doing its job like it's supposed to.
Although you do know, I mean, obviously people are usually either right eye or left eye dominant, so it's not necessarily abnormal to have.
It's not, no, correct. It's not necessarily abnormal, but it doesn't mean it's optimal, right? I mean, so there's dysfunction, there's normalcy, and then there's optimal function. And there's obviously a range and a gamut within that. And so, you know, most of us do live with some level of dysfunction and our body adapts and we survive, but most of us have pain too, right? So, you know, I think we're at a really interesting intersection with what we're doing at Radiant, because pain is such a big problem. As you mentioned, it's probably understated. In the United States, over 100 million people are reported to have chronic pain.
Right.
And, you know, that's more than cancer, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease combined. So it's a big population of people that are, you know, hurting on a pretty regular basis. And many of them feel baffled and betrayed by these bodies that, you know, are hurting. And in many cases, their doctors haven't been able to help them identify or resolve it. And it's kind of inexplicable as to why it hurts.
So you talk about, you know, there's a difference between, I think, you know, a clearly identifiable anatomical purpose for pain. In your case, perhaps it was a, you know, L2, L3 disc herniation, which, you know, 90-some% of the time that pain's going to go away on its own about, you know, within about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
But then there's also a kind of pain that sometimes you cannot identify exactly what the source is. And I presume you're kind of focusing more on that. Is that right?
Or that's absolutely right. Okay. Yeah. We look at pain as a protective function. You know, if you have your hand on the hot stove or you've broken a bone or you have cancer growing in your tissue,
sure,
you want to be feeling pain because it's going to get your attention. You're going to seek care and it's going to get resolved, hopefully.
Got it.
In chronic pain, though, we define chronic pain as pain that's been present longer than is appropriate. As you mentioned, 6 weeks or so, tissue should heal. The pain should subside. It's no longer necessary in most cases. So when it's lingering longer, or when the pain is growing disproportionate to a cause, or in some cases there's no cause, like fibromyalgia for many people is kind of an inexplicable pain experience that's happening and growing over time. This is a non-productive type of pain experience. It's not serving the person. It's just literally a pain. And it could actually be causing further problems, because if they're hurting, likely they're moving less than they otherwise would, which would probably, you know, incline them to gain weight. Their sleep is likely disrupted. And that combination of factors creates many other comorbidities and problems. And then most of us just pop pills. And so the pills then inevitably, you know, we become dose tolerant to them. We have to keep upping the dosing. And inevitably there's some sort of, you know, chemistry change in the body or side effect that starts to happen, or addiction, or a combination of these things. And, you know, we have obviously this very omnipresent opioid addiction epidemic that's kind of in the news. Sure. And so, you know, we just feel really fortunate to have a therapy that's, safe, very effective.
Let's talk a little bit about, so you met up with Dr. Farley.
Yep.
And he is a physician.
He is a medical doctor. Yeah. Getting trained at Harvard and MIT. Yeah.
What kind of physician is he? What specialty is he?
He's a family medicine doctor, and he would tell you, much to the chagrin of his instructors and professors and colleagues at Harvard and MIT, he chose to go into family medicine after doing some residencies, and has been in clinical practice for about 30 years here in the Portland area.
Got it. And so tell me about the actual treatment. If you're talking about treating, I guess, in a non-pharmaceutical way, what's the novel treatment that you're proposing with this?
Yeah. So again, you know, with the philosophy and understanding of the most recent neuroscience is that pain is neurogenic. It's driven from the brain experience in the tissue. And again, in the short term, it's protective. In the long term, it's not so protective. And the brain essentially becomes habitualized or wired to kind of expect and perpetuate the pain phenomenon in a way that's no longer serving a protective function. So rather than trying to mask it at the tissues, or mask it with the drug, or address it at the pain site, the tissue site where the pain is experienced, we are able to transmit new information. We have an FDA cleared medical device that we identified and, been spending the last few years really learning and position ourselves to be able to control. FDA cleared, been researched at the Mayo Clinic and Johns Hopkins, but ignored by mainstream medicine because it was predicated on a TENS unit when it was taken through the FDA. And so TENS has obviously been around for many, many decades. And, you know, this is in many clinicians' first blush an overly priced TENS unit, but it's actually quite different. So the technology acts like an artificial nerve, essentially. It generates a dynamic set of artificial nerve impulses. We attach electrodes on the skin in healthy tissue that doesn't hurt, but is, you know, in proximity to the painful area. We turn the device on. We begin to generate those impulses from the, you know, from the technology through the wires of the machine up through the peripheral nerves, through what is called the C fibers of the nervous system, then in through the CNS and into the brain. The brain receives these impulses and begins to interpret them essentially as an endogenous or a natural self-generated message, and it begins to ease the pain experience. What happens is that the messaging coming out of the device is dynamic and changing. So the brain doesn't become tolerant to it. It has to kind of respond to this. And this helps break up these neurotags or these associations or wirings that are perpetuating the pain experience. It begins to break those up, and the brain is able, through neuroplasticity or its ability to learn, it's able to create a more normalized perception of pain. We give the first treatment for free because in many cases it's pretty profound after some education about what we're doing and how we do it and why we do it. And then to give, you know, the experience of it, the relief that many clients see is pretty profound, but it's really a process of repetition and exposure in order to change the brain and help to restore the brain back to a more normal pain experience.
So, you know, you mentioned something, and I'd like to kind of focus on it again, because as putting my physician hat on and neuro guy back on, a transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation unit, which is a TENS unit, as you discussed.
Yep.
It works essentially the way you're describing. It's a tingling, buzzing sensation on your skin, drives up sensations into your, you know, ultimately through your peripheral nervous system up into your brain, blocks or suppresses pain messages to your brain. It can also stimulate, you know, the body to produce higher levels of our own natural painkillers, like endorphins, et cetera. So tell me, and tell all the doctors out there too, because we're all wondering the same thing. How is this different?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And it is significantly different. It's different in both the output, the intensity, the waveform, and the dynamics of the impulse that's happening. Again, it's not a static message. It's a dynamic and changing message, which is all important. Also, the way that it's administered on the body. So again, a TENS unit is typically placed in the painful area. You're creating an analgesic experience because you're creating a new sensation in that area that's being experienced as pain. In our case, we're not just trying to mask the pain by giving that, masking sensation or new experience there, but giving the brain new information so that it can go through the neuroplastic changing capability that it has to be able to learn and get, basically it's breaking up those associations that it's wired to expect of pain,
right,
giving it the information so that it can normalize itself. And so we are able to achieve relief that becomes durable or lasting for weeks or months. In some cases it's indefinite, and without these side effects and risks, it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still not necessarily understanding the difference between the TENS unit based on what you just said, but are there any studies right now comparing?
There's a few pilot studies that have been done at Mayo Clinic and Johns Hopkins. There's been economic challenges by the former licensee in terms of how do they really commercialize this. That TENS predication has ruined really an economic reimbursement potential with insurance because it's predicated on a TENS unit. And so TENS reimbursement is quite low, as you know. So what we've done is, basically we're building a direct-to-consumer business around this technology because we saw an opportunity that seemed really quite promising. Right. So we spent the last 5 years really understanding, does it A, work? B, can we create a replicable, consistent business that allows us to be able to deliver consistent results? And then can we build a business model that makes it affordable without insurance coverage and still create an economic return?
I get that. And before we get to that, though, I guess, it is sort of my fiduciary responsibility to do the due diligence here, especially given the fact that, I know a thing or two about this stuff in general. What I'm trying to say is that typically the way we will judge in medicine, whether something is better or different is through some kind of, double blind placebo
You're absolutely
study,
right. Yeah.
Or in this case, do you have any reason to, from the studies, say that this works better than a TENS unit? What I'm drawing the distinction between is subjective, anecdotal data from your clinics, which I'm not saying is insignificant. I'm asking like whether there are any studies right now showing differences.
There are studies showing differences, and they're on our website, and certainly happy to make them available to the audience that would be interested to review those. But they are limited. I mean, in full disclosure, they're limited. And what I found, so prior to starting Radiant, I spent a few years trying to sell this technology to physicians. Mm-hmm. The experience that I encountered was that most professional clinicians, MDs, and including the gamut of alternative care physicians are trained in pain science from the 1960s, the gate control theory of pain. And Melzack and Wall, I believe, were the publishers of that theory and model. And Melzack in the late 90s basically created a new theory called the pain neuromatrix theory, which essentially kind of debunked it. And in a sense, it says that, that pain is multifactorial and that it's a real brain component driven versus what's, kind of explained in the gate control theory of pain. So we found that many clinicians didn't understand the science that kind of underlined both the more modern understanding of pain and, the mechanism of action of our therapy. There was an economic disincentive for them to adopt this therapy because it's very costly. One device that retails over $100,000 and there's no viable reimbursement. So that's an economic challenge. And then you have an opportunity cost because, there's other resources that you have that are built into your practice and to redirect those into something that is hard to, figure out how do you price and command a reasonable value to. So that combination of factors made it really hard. And then there's limited studies. So as I went out to talk to doctors about it, this combination of factors really made it hard for us to create a level of trust and understanding, because to your point, physicians are trained to look at the studies, to read the studies. They want to see double blind placebo controlled longitudinal outcomes if possible. And the reality is that doesn't happen. But the therapy does work really remarkably well. And having personally spent about a decade in the hearing aid industry, hearing aids are not covered by insurance. They're not cheap. An average sale price for a set of hearing aids is about $7,000 or $8,000. I thought, well, if this technology really does work and people are willing to spend money, and I think you've worked also as a cosmetic surgeon for a while as well, so you know people are willing to spend money for things that are important to them if they see the value and understand it. I created a different business concept, which is to build clinics and go right to the consumer, because I can't create studies that don't exist. I can't fund studies that don't exist. I didn't have the rights to the technology to do that. And, you know, would it be illogical for me to have, you know, deployed that type of capital if I had it. So I said, let's just see if we can create a consumer appeal that makes this work. And so what we've done is the last 5 years, we've really been in the learning mode. You know, we've been generating revenue, but we really consider it pre-revenue and really kind of a learning of both the therapeutic and the business side of things to marry them in a way that we think can be quite appealing. What we've seen is that we average across, I don't know the exact number, but it's over 500 people that we've treated over the last 5 years, an average reduction of about 84% on the VAS scale. So people come in, they typically measure pain from 0 to 10. And, you know, most of our clients are coming in pretty high levels of pain, enough that they're willing to, you know, eventually invest in our therapy. But if they're at a 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, we average shift that down 84%. So we may not fully resolve the pain. Pain is obviously a very human experience that we all have. Right? I mean, we want to set reasonable expectations, but it's significant to the point where we've seen people who previously have, you know, many of our clients have tried everything, quote unquote. You know, I mean, we've had people that have elected to have, for example, a leg amputated after years of failed therapies, you know, drug addiction and nothing resolving their pain. Many of our clients tell us they've become suicidal. And we have one client in particular who was so fed up, he elected to have his leg amputated. They amputate his leg. It becomes phantom pain because it's a neurogenic problem, not really a tissue problem at this point. And at this point, he was in a very dark place. Fortunately, he didn't take his life and didn't take other drastic measures. And we were able to treat him. And he's, you know, his testimonial and in fact, news clip, a local news station covered his story. You know, it's remarkable to see these people get their lives back. And so, you know, we don't have the answer that most physicians want in the sense of what is, you know, the study evidence of it, but we have certainly, you know, our own internal data and clinical results and anecdotal stories that are mind blowing.
No, and I totally get it. And I'm not trying to discredit by any means. I think that there's two different things we're talking about here. One is, which, you know, there's a lot of things out there that tend to work for people that there isn't a lot of studies on. For the longest time, we didn't have a lot of information on acupuncture. Now we do have information on acupuncture. The primary thing I was trying to get at is, you know, from a neurophysiology standpoint, I'm trying to just try to make that distinction, try to understand exactly what the difference is. But let's focus a little bit on the business side of this, because obviously this is an investing show.
Yeah.
It is not a medicine show. Let's talk a little bit about, well, first of all, you were featured in Inc. magazine. Your book was. Tell us about your book. What was that all about?
Well, our vision is to build a chain of stores, and these are treatment centers. But, you know, our brand is called Radiant Pain Relief Centers. And the vision of building clinics is twofold. Number one, it allows us to create consistency in the experience, to create a whole new experience. In fact, we've modeled the entire business model around delivering this therapy in the most effective and consistent and appealing way. So we've created these centers, and we have a couple here in Portland that we've been learning through and refining. But, you know, they allow us to create consistency, which is necessary to build a brand. And as we control the brand, we control the revenue and the, you know, the P&L for the center, we have a vested interest to want to now start to promote that directly to consumer and create a return. It allows us to create efficiencies in that so that we can price it to be affordable. In fact, it averages around $10 a day for our clients to get and maintain relief, depending on how much they use it, and still build very profitable enterprise as a business. Our growth model, just to touch on this real quick, is instead of, you know, opening the centers and owning them and, you know, having to have the capital to do that, is to create an investment opportunity for local clinicians. Instead of selling them a device for $100,000 that they then have a high opportunity cost and have to try to figure out, does it really work? How do I make it work? You know, both, you know, clinically and financially, they can invest a much lower amount of money in a local center that we build It's completely passive for them. There's no opportunity cost. They can refer if and when it makes sense, and they get a return based upon the performance of that center that's uncorrelated to their referrals. So it's clean of Stark laws and anti-kickback laws. And this will allow us to use local capital to create hopefully fans and influencers and referrers in the market and be able to accelerate our growth. So that's our kind of our business.
So what you're doing right now is a regulation crowdfunding or regulation AAA offering.
Well, right now we're in a Reg D. So we're still closing out a private placement. At the time of this recording, we're headed to Kevin Harrington's Angel Investor Network event in the middle of March. And that and a couple other things, we hope to be able to close out our private placement round soon. And then we will go into a crowdfunded public offering opportunity. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was just out of curiosity, what was the structure of your private placement? What kind of GPLP and structure was that?
Yeah, initially it was a convertible debt. And then as we began to make plans and, you know, submit to the SEC to prepare for the Reg A Plus, we went through a conversion process and converted everybody into equity. And we since then have been raising money in equity. And then in the Reg A Plus, basically created a new company that's primarily focus on just the technology piece, not all the infrastructure and management of the centers, just the technology is a simpler business. And in that, you know, we'll sell equity, obviously, right to the crowd. Anybody, non-accredited investors can participate in that low price point.
And what will that typically look like in terms of GPLP split on that kind of thing?
In terms of what will the dilution or the valuation be? Is that what you're asking?
Well, I mean, presumably this is something that I'm just wondering how it's structured, obviously. I mean, we're, you know, if you've got a fund, so, yep. You know, it'll be, you know, Reg AAA, whatever, but, you know, is it, you know, a 2-in-20? Is it, you know, is there some kind of split? What's between the operator side and the...
Yeah. So what we've done is we've sold, getting convertible debt initially and then migrated into equity. We've been selling equity since then in Radiant Health Management Corporation, which is right now an Oregon C Corp. And that's the management company that will run and manage and grow the assets for the individual clinics. We've created a new company and basically replicated the cap table from the Radiant Health Management Company, replicated it as founders in the new company. So for our investors in that private placement, there's no cost. Additional cost to then become quote unquote a founder in the new company. It's that new company, the Radiant Technology Holdings, that will take through this Reg A Plus. And so we'll raise money at a much higher valuation in that new technology company. And then we have two businesses that are different. One is focused on management and operations. One is a technology holding and, you know, selling company. The technology company is a pretty simple business to operate because we buy and or manufacture technology at price X. We sell it at price Y. Not a lot of operating complexity. So a bulk of that revenue flows right to the bottom line, giving us the ability to create a dividend potential for investors in that side of the business. And then our plan is to take, we have two entities and, you know, there's a potential, you know, acquisition opportunity with somebody like a DaVita or some other aggregator that might want to buy the management company at some point. And then, you know, the other company that's focused on technology may be more appealing to a technology-based company like a, you know, a Medtronic or J&J or somebody, you know, bigger down the road. Or what our plan is currently is to try to keep our fortunes as controlled as much as possible. Ultimately, once we've grown the company over a couple of years period of time, merge those back together. So there's going to create a partial liquidity event for the shareholders in Radiant Health Management Corp. Merge those companies back together and then uplist on an exchange and take the company, you know, public through an IPO. Probably about 3 years down the road.
Got it. And tell me, you got the, obviously you've got the Oregon, the shop in Oregon.
Yeah.
How's that one doing?
Therapeutically, it's doing phenomenally well. From a business standpoint, we're right on track with our key performance indicators. So we've had basically a pilot operation. We're now able to grow those to full capacity, and we're going to be opening a new center in Boston here in about 90 days, Los Angeles to follow.
Are you profitable in Oregon?
We're not net profitable, but we are seeing the KPIs that would indicate as we grow scale, we'll hit profitability.
So, and that one's been about 3 years. What's your KPIs, where do they predict profitability?
Yeah. So a single center takes about $500,000 to capitalize and open, and it should grow. And I'll talk about our revenue model because we've really refined that revenue model to make it an appealing aspect to our clinical business too. But a single center will grow to over about 2.5 to 3 year period of time as it hits maturity, about $1 million in top line revenue and net about 35% EBITDA profits out of that center.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. Well, listen, it was good, good talking to you and definitely, good luck. How do we learn more about the business and potentially get involved with the offering if it's something that people are interested in?
Yeah, thank you, Buck. Well, we'd love to chat with anybody, clinicians or non-clinicians. I mean, pain is a really significant problem, and the opioid addiction epidemic obviously makes this pretty urgent. So, you know, if you're interested, the best place is to go to a simple landing page that we have at radiantrelief.com. And there you can indicate if you're a clinician and you want more information about the science or the business opportunity related to clinicians, if you're interested in the Reg A Plus, if you're interested in the private placement, if that's still open at the time, if you're just interested in the book or following our story, or if you have pain yourself. That's the best place to go, and we'll get you the appropriate information and route you appropriately. But radiantrelief.com.
Brendan, thanks so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure, Buck. Thank you so much. Cheers.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show, everyone. I'm curious what you guys thought of that interview. I mean, it is good to, you know, hear about different things going on. I would love to hear from, you know, some of you neurologists in particular. Did I do a good job, John? Did I do a good job? Did I ask the right questions? You know, I'm just a dumb surgeon, so I don't necessarily know. Yes, I used to be in the neurosurgical field some time ago, and I really was into neuroscience, but at the end of the day, I was a dumb surgeon, not an actual neurologist. So anyway, any of you neurologists out there who have something to say about this, chime in, and I'll even mention on Wealth Formula Network on our next call. Now for me, this is, this of course is an investment opportunity that I would categorize as high risk. And it's not anything against this particular company. It's not anything against Brendan or even the technology. It could be the best technology ever, but it is a startup. And understand that startups are still by nature that type of investment that can be, you know, high reward, but also very high risk. It's not like investing in real estate, right? But there are lots of ways to invest outside of stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and even real estate that are riskier and sometimes provide higher reward. For those of you who know, for me, that happens to be in the area of blockchain, and that's my high risk stuff. So I'm not really necessarily into the startup world because I'm not a person who I think is really good at evaluating startups. This is something that could be really interesting to those of you who are interested in startup technologies. So make sure to check out their website and, you know, ask them questions, et cetera. And if it's of interest, then move forward. Anyway, that is it for me this week on Wealth Formula Podcast. This is Buck Joffrey signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Joffrey here from Sapio with Buck Joffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at sapiopodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, sapiopodcast.com.